This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. When I was a lot younger, I was fascinated by pro wrestlers. My brother and I bought every wrestling magazine that came out, and we would pore over the photo spreads and try to learn everything we could about these larger-than-life men. Men like Haystack Calhoun, who weighed 650 pounds, Killer Kowalski, the original Zebra Kids. I probably read about my guest back then. Ted Lewin was a professional wrestler from the early 50s to the mid-60s. He used the money he earned in the ring to pay for art school. As he writes in his new memoir, I Was a Teenage Professional Wrestler, Renoir, Rubens, and Picasso by day, headlocks, hammerlocks, and flying tackles by night. After nearly 15 years, he gave up his wrestling career and set up shop as a freelance illustrator of children's books. And although he left the world of wrestling, his affection for the players has never diminished. Lewin told me that his love for wrestling began when he was a young boy.
My first exposure to it really was my father taking my kid brother and myself to the wrestling matches in Buffalo. We'd go there and watch the matches and practice every single thing we learned and watched, and my kid brother and I became, I think, professional wrestlers by the time we were, or would be professional wrestlers by the time we were about 10 or 11 years old.
Now, what did you like about what you saw there?
Well, I've always wanted to be an artist ever since the day I can remember, and I think there was something about the theater and the art of watching these guys and the wonderful athleticism. I mean, I've always been interested in that too, and kind of the combination of art and athletics, if you will, I guess, was what really attracted me. The now, show business, I guess.
Did your father somehow have high hopes for you and your brothers, thinking my sons are going to make it as professional wrestlers?
No, I think it was probably the biggest surprise in his life when we started doing this. My older brother got into it first when he got out of World War II, got in the Marines, and was a bodybuilder, had a wonderful physique, and they kind of recruited him. The promoter in Buffalo, Ed Don George, they wanted a local boy, and my brother was it. My father was well-known in town there as a retail jewelry store he had for 52 years, so the name was well-known, and here's my brother, the bodybuilder and the ex-Marine hero, and it was a perfect combination. And when he started that, my father was kind of anxious about it. My mother too. They thought he's going to get hurt. You know, they couldn't go to the matches. They couldn't watch it. It was just too much for him. And then when Brother Don gave me a call, he was out in Ohio, his second or third year in the business, and I was ready to go to art school and needed a summer job. He said, "Why don't you come out and be my tag partner?" And we were, of course, ready. Got kid brother and myself, because we'd been doing this since we were 10 years old and waiting for my debut, you know.
Now, you became a professional wrestler in 1952. You were 17 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember your first professional match?
Let's see. I don't remember exactly. There's been thousands of them in the interim. I don't remember exactly, but it was a tag match with my brother, because when I first started out, the promoters in Ohio thought, well, the best thing to do is put the kid in with his brother and make sure that he doesn't sort of get lost somewhere in the shuffle. But I can't tell you exactly who it was. I don't remember.
Now, did you have a shtick? Did you and your brothers have a shtick? And most wrestlers either have a kind of fancy costume or they have a kind of persona that mm-hmm. they strut around in the arena.
Or they don't have anything, which makes you kind of a baby face, which is our term sort of for the nice-looking young man who is is going to be not going to do any dirty tricks, and he's going to be the recipient of the dirty tricks, and the villain is the guy that does the dirty tricks. So we all sort of look the part of the clean-cut fellow that wouldn't do anybody any harm, and we wore kind of red, at least my brother and myself at the time, my brother Don wore patriotic red, white, and blue baseball jackets and had no real gimmick, as it's called. Later on, both my brothers, as they stayed in the business for 25, 30 years, my kid brother's still kind of wandering around the world in it. They took on all kind of personas. My kid brother became Maniac Mark for a while, and my older brother did a few comebacks as the Mask Terror, I think he was called. The old timers sometimes put on masks, and then they're a new timer, you know. But my brother Don never got away with it too well, because he had a couple of obvious injuries. He'd torn a bicep muscle once during a match, and that there was no way of hiding that injury. His bicep was kind of slightly deformed. And so he put a hood on and go in the ring as the Golden Masked Terror. And everybody, hey, Don, they knew who he was anyway. You know, couldn't hide that.
Now, before we go too much farther, I do want to talk a little bit about the theatrics and how much of wrestling, and we're talking back 50s and mid-60s, mm-hmm. how much of that was really a sport and how much of that was a put on. There's a picture of you and a guy named Bill Curry, and you have
Bull Curry.
Excuse mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. You have him in a headlock, mm-hmm. and you have this grimace on your face. Mm-hmm. Now, are you squeezing the living daylights out of his neck, or are you just putting on a face for us?
Well, I'm squeezing him, but I don't know that I could hurt him any worse than he'd already been hurt over the years. No, it's kind of a combination of what you see when you see college wrestling or amateur wrestling, and that's the basis for it. And then you add all the ingredients, the things that are the things people pay to see, and that's the flying. Nobody would really pay to see, I think, an amateur wrestling match. They go because they love it and they know what it is. But the paying to see it, getting people excited, that's flying around the ring, and that's body slams and drop kicks and all the aerial maneuvers, the things that are very, very dangerous to do. Dangerous not only to your opponent but to yourself. And those are the things that need to be perfected so you don't hurt yourself. So it's kind of a combination of those two things. There's no intent to maim or kill each other. That would be counterproductive. But there certainly is a great deal of danger. And I talk about it a lot in the book. As you know, the whole section on the kind of injuries that
sure.
that people have received. I remember once my brother Don was wrestling Nature Boy Buddy Rogers, and it was backdrop. That's where you're flying off the ropes towards your opponent, and he bends down and catches you in kind of in midair and flips you over his back. And they were standing very close to the ring ropes, and my brother Don cleared the top of the ring ropes and landed 15 feet down because the stage was set up on a theater in an old theater house, and he fell to 15 feet to the floor. And continued the match and everything, but he injured two vertebrae in his two discs in his back that day, and it was never really right until 15 years later. He had a laminectomy, a spine fused operation to alleviate the pain. So it was always the possibility of serious injury because of the dangerous maneuvers, which are what people really like to see.
Well, with the kind of grueling schedule that you have described for us, what did you do to actually stay in shape, or was just wrestling just about every day what you did to stay in shape?
Well, that helped, but almost all the guys trained in the gym. So they would get up early in the morning, train in the gym, or run. A lot of them did both, and get on the road. And if they couldn't train, that evening's matches, was the best they could do. But they all trained a lot, and I think we're all in excellent condition too, because a lot of them stayed in the business for longevity is terrific. It's not like baseball or other sports where a 40-year-old is getting already pretty old to be playing. A lot of the wrestlers were in their 50s and even 60s. I can remember when I first started, there were guys that had been wrestling for a very long time, and they seemed like they were ancient then to me, and they were in their late 50s and early 60s and looked incredible, and they were able to move with the best of them. They never lost that. In fact, they somehow got smoother and better, and they got hurt less as they got older because they got smarter.
Did you earn a lot of money as a wrestler?
Well, my brothers did because they were main eventers. They went on the road and they moved from place to place and were always a top, got main events, were top men. But I was going to art school. That was my primary idea. That's why I was wrestling, to help pay my way through school. And I wanted to be an illustrator. That was my goal. Their goal was to be the best they could in the wrestling business. So that requires traveling the country and requires being 3 months, 4 months in one place and on to another, so that you're always a fresh face and you can always bring something new to a different area. But I was what they call a local guy. I stayed in one area, and whenever they needed somebody for a preliminary match or to fill in, that was me. And it was I earned plenty of money as far as paying my way through art school and paying my expenses, and it was very helpful when I left school, because starting to freelance as a freelance illustrator is a very, very tough proposition, and most of my friends had to take some kind of a job to support themselves, and I had the wrestling. A few nights a week did it.
Well, did you feel that you had you were leading a double life? I'm wondering whether wrestlers saw you draw and whether your fellow artists saw you wrestle.
Oh, sure. I always carried a sketchbook in the dressing room and constantly drew them and made a series of paintings which are in the color section in the book. During that time, I wanted to kind of record all the the magic of it. And for me, it always was kind of a magical thing because of this temporary kind of feeling. I was very much one of the boys, as we say. They accepted me. I could perform with the best of them, and my brothers were both in the business, so I was really one of them. But they also knew that I had this other goal, and a lot of them were college graduates. A lot of them understood my desire to get through school and you know, shoot for something else, and so they knew that was going on, but it didn't interfere with an acceptance, you know.
Well, you have one of my favorite wrestlers from my youth in your book, and that's Haystack Calhoun. I guess and I was probably about 10 years old at the time. Mm-hmm. He was so large.
large is right. I remember what.
He was captivating.
We should maybe describe him. Around 600 pounds, and I think about it back then, he was really quite young. He wasn't too much older than I was. I was 17, 18, 19 when I first met him. And I don't think he was only a very few years older. He wore his hair, long black hair, all the way down to his shoulders and a little goatee. And he wore denims, overalls, and walked around barefooted and wore a chain around it, a big, heavy chain around his neck with a horseshoe hanging on it.
Well, I remember reading what he had for breakfast every day.
Oh,
and,
God.
You know, it was three loaves of bread, three dozen eggs, boxes of cereal.
He had to go everywhere by car, all his matches, because there was no way he could fit into an airliner seat. Or into a train seat, for that matter. He was kind of stuck driving everywhere, but a very sweet man. I remember several times being his tag partner, and he kind of stood in the corner while me, being the smaller, more mobile of the two, did all the running around and drop kicks and whatever else, and finally maneuvering our opponent in the right position, and then Haystack would come in and fall on him, and that ended it. But I can remember once being picked up and just really realizing the size of him. Because after the match, I remember, to kind of celebrate our victory, he picked me up like I was a rag doll and hugged me. And I remember is being smothered in denim. And, you know, he was so huge, like an elephant, you know.
Did the audience ever scare you more than your opponent?
Well, there were times when the audience were pretty scary. You know, the intent of, if you're having a really good match, the idea is to get the crowd riled up and, it should be controlled. You know, you can kind of handle the heat. You can keep people, or you should be able to keep people during a match within some kind of reason. But something will trigger a crowd sometimes. Maybe it's the certain half a dozen people in the front row or something, but it can spill over. And I've been involved in many riots where it got really out of hand. And of course, you're in the ring naked and vulnerable, and crowd starts pouring into the ring, and it gets very, very dangerous.
So what do you do?
Well, both wrestlers sort of it's what you do in a shark attack, really. You get back to back and start flailing out, right? But usually there are other wrestlers watching this from the sidelines, kind of back in the chutes to the dressing room. When they see it start to happen, you can feel it when it's going to happen, they immediately kind of bunch up and push their way through the crowd and get near the edge of the ring. And if the crowd spills over into the ring, they push their way up, and then it becomes kind of a phalanx of wrestlers and sometimes special police and officials, whoever happens to be there that it can help, and they kind of surround the two main participants. Usually it's the villain that the crowd is very angry at, and they want to get to him. And I remember a riot once in the old St. Nick's Arena, and it was Mr. Israel, who was a wrestling rabbi, wrestling.
He really was a
rabbi. Yeah, and Raphael Halpern was his name, and he was wrestling Hans Schmidt, who was doing Nazi salutes and all of that. And I must say that crowd really went over. They threw whole rows of chairs from the balcony into the ring, and it was a very, very dangerous place to be. I remember some of the commissioners getting hit with flying chairs and bottles, and it was really terrible. They actually closed St. Nick's down soon after that, and I think that was one of the reasons. It really did get out of hand in that place.
Well, you know, I'm going to talk a little bit more, but first we have to take a very short break, okay. And my guest today is Ted Lewin, and he is now an illustrator, artist illustrator of children's books, but back in the 50s and 60s, he was a professional wrestler, and he's written a memoir about those years. The book is called I Was a Teenage Professional Wrestler. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with artist Ted Lewin, and we're talking about his years as a professional wrestler. Did any of your fans ever write you letters?
They used to, yeah, sometimes they used to, and send pictures. They used to take, some of the pictures are in the book, as a matter of fact. They'd take a snapshot, you know, they'd run up and take a quick snapshot or something, and then figure you might like to have it, or they'd run up and ask if they could have a picture with you, and then they'd send it to you and write their name on the back and the date and all of that. I collected some of those. It was kind of fun.
Did you like the fame? I mean, the fact that you could part a crowd.
Yeah, I think that's a sort of that's addictive. You know, it was very hard to stop. You know, finally the time came when it was very hard to travel and you know, to kind of say, can you go to Pittsburgh? And I said, I can't do that. I'm working on an illustration. I have a deadline. So it got very, very difficult once I really got busy doing what I really, really wanted to do. I just had to finally ease off and not be able to do it anymore, and I really missed it. I had friends that I'd made over 15 years of wrestling, and once I stopped, I never saw them again.
Really?
Yeah, and the only way to see them, I heard about them through my brothers who would tell me this guy's doing that, and that, you know, Bull Curry's retired or so, you know, that kind of thing. But you never really saw them again, and they were like, you traveled and lived day and night with them for years and years. But to answer your question, yeah, the ability to be able to do a specific move and know exactly what reaction that's going to have to a crowd, if you do it right, is there's this kind of wonderful feeling of, I don't know, in a way control, but it's also very creative because the matches just happen. You know, something will come. It's like dancing. You'll try a step and it'll work beautifully and the crowd will love it. You'll just take off on that and expound on it, go more with it. You know, if it doesn't work, you try something else. So in a way, it's very creative. It's like painting. You know, I always saw it kind of as a creative extension, really.
Well, do you still miss wrestling?
I do, you know. Maybe I should tell you about what sort of started the book in the first place. That some friends of mine one night said, you know, we know you used to wrestle, and he said, but we've never been to the wrestling matches. Mm-hmm. This is years after I stopped wrestling, and they said there's going to be some wrestling matches right nearby in Brooklyn at American Legion Hall in Greenpoint, and just the next section over from where I live in Brooklyn. They said, would you come as our guest and kind of do the local color and tell us what's happening? And I said, oh, I don't know that I want to do that. You know, I feel funny. And they said, they talked me into it. So we went. It was about six friends and myself and my wife, and we sat at the ringside, and I walked into this smoke-filled dump, you know, and I thought, oh, gosh, it's the old days. And the nostalgia was starting to kill me, you know. And I said, wait a minute, I want to see if any of the old boys are still around, you know. And I went in the back and I said, and I remember a friend, Arnold Golden Boy Skoland, used to kind of, as they say, take care of the shows. He would arrange the matches and pay the boys and take the money back to the office, that kind of thing. And we were very, very good friends for 15 years, and I hadn't seen him in 15 years. And so I said, is he around? And they said, who wants to know? And I told him, and the guy looked at me like he was seeing a ghost, you know. Hi. Ran downstairs, and then he come running up, and he dragged me down. It was like old home week. I mean, we were hugging and kissing everybody, you know. And meanwhile, my friends are upstairs wondering, where the heck is he? He's supposed to be doing the color here, you know. And my wife said, oh, he's seeing his old friends and visiting and everything. What happened is Arnold Skoland said to me, you know, one of the wrestlers didn't show up. He said, I need somebody to fill in. He said, would you do that? And I thought, how can I do that? I mean, it's been 15 years. And then I thought, how can I not do that with my six friends who had never seen it and my wife who couldn't imagine it sitting out there? So I live so close by, I grabbed one of the friends, swore him to secrecy. He drove me home, and I sort of ransacked the house to find my old bag with my old wrestling gear that I hadn't seen in 15 years. Ran back.
Wait, did it still fit?
Sure, it still fit. Yeah. Oh, I stay very fit. And it was just the way I packed it away, like a museum piece, you know. And I put it on, and I had to get examined. I had to buy a New York State license because you can't wrestle without one. And I walked into the ring in the semifinal match, and my friends looked up. I'll tell you, the looks on their face, you just cannot believe. My wife couldn't believe it. And I was wrestling a guy named Johnny Ross, who actually broke in 2 or 3 years after I did, and was kind of still at it. You know, and during the match, he threw me right out on their laps, and they never quite got over it. But that experience, I called up a friend of mine, Ed Grimm, who's a writer, and I told him on the phone, I told him my whole experience. He said, you ought to write that down. He said, that really is wonderful, and sent it into the Times. So I did that, and they ran a little op-ed piece about it, which prompted an editor at Dodd Mead said, why don't you expand on that? And to make a long story short, 13 years later, I still hadn't found a publisher for the book. They couldn't figure out exactly what the audience would be. And then wonderful editor Dick Jackson at Orchard Books said, you know, it's a young adult book. It's a great story for kids. So it took 13 years, though, to kind of to find a home for it. And it all happened, it all started because of that one night comeback.
So when you were in the ring, much to the surprise to your friends and your wife, did the moves come back to you?
Like riding a bicycle.
Really?
Yeah. It's interesting because we'd all been out having a big party beforehand, eating lots of food, drinking lots of wine. So it's amazing that that I didn't lose that all, as a matter of fact. But the moves, you never forget them. I could right now go in the ring and have a half-hour match without having forgotten one thing. It becomes so automatic and so natural, like dancing. You don't really ever learn forget how to dance. You may get a little rusty, but you don't ever really forget it. And I hadn't forgotten a thing.
Well, I want to thank you, Ted Lewin, for joining us and talking with us about your life as a professional wrestler. It's been a real treat.
My pleasure.
Ted Lewin is an artist and illustrator. His memoir is called I Was a Teenage Professional Wrestler. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.